Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio. Let's get right into some headlines from around New Mexico. Former New Mexico State Representative Cheryl Williams Stapleton is facing more than two dozen federal charges. They include mail fraud, money laundering, and bribery. Federal investigators allege Stapleton stole more than $3 million, including $2.5 million in federal money through her position as an Albuquerque Public Schools program manager. The former State House Majority Leader is accused of sending the money to a Washington, D.C.-based company that she helped run. From there, the feds allege a trail of money leading to Stapleton's Albuquerque restaurant and charity organization, netting her more than $1 million. The new federal charges come after state prosecutors charged Stapleton with 28 counts, including racketeering, fraud, and money laundering. That case is still pending, and a scheduled trial date in January got pushed back. Her arraignment on those federal charges is set for April 9th. The Navajo Nation and San Juan County have agreed to adopt a new voting map that advocates say would give Native American voters the voice they deserve in local elections. The dispute first began in 2021 when five Navajo voters joined the Navajo Nation's Department of Justice and Human Rights Commission to sue San Juan County. They claimed the county's map violated the Federal Voting Rights Act. According to the Navajo Nation, that map diluted indigenous voting power by lumping a majority of Native American voters into one district. More than 40% of voters in the county are Native American. The settlement now means that Native American voters will be more evenly spread out across two districts, with indigenous voters making up 71% of District 1 and 67% of District 2. This map will remain in effect until the next census in 2030. Correspondent Gwyneth Doland has been following the case closely since the lawsuit was filed. We'll have more from her on the settlement in the coming weeks. This Friday, two environmental regulatory boards will consider pausing a clean car rule that would require more than 40% of new vehicles for sale by auto dealerships to be zero emission. On April 5th, both the New Mexico Environmental Improvement Board and the Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Air Quality Control Board will continue hearing opposition and support for the Advanced Clean Cars and Trucks rule. Both boards passed the new regulations this fall. They'd be enacted in 2026 and would require 43% of all new passenger cars and light-duty trucks shipped to the state to be zero-emission vehicles. The rule is modeled after similar regulations passed in California in 2022. Turning now to Las Cruces, the state's law enforcement certification board met in the city last week to consider discipline against 18 police officers, including LCPD officers Brad Lunsford and Felipe Hernandez. A grand jury in December indicted Lunsford on an involuntary manslaughter charge in the shooting death of Presley Eze, a black man suspected of stealing a single can of beer. In January, Doña Ana County District Attorney Gerald Byers announced a second-degree murder charge against Felipe Hernandez after Hernandez shot and killed 45-year-old Teresa Gomez while she tried to drive away. The Law Enforcement Certification Board is in charge of certifying police officers in New Mexico. A spokesperson for the New Mexico Department of Public Safety tells me the board voted unanimously during its meeting last week to table the decision on whether to revoke the two officers' credentials. The Las Cruces Bulletin reports attorneys for Lunsford and Hernandez asked for an extension because they couldn't be at the hearing. That DPS spokesman tells me the board will likely take their cases back up in June. A state office that doesn't get much attention but oversees hundreds of millions of dollars in oil and gas revenue each year made it into the headlines earlier this month. The State Land Office announced in early March it would hold off on selling oil and gas leases on some of the state's most promising tracts, until state lawmakers lock in a higher rate. That's after a measure to increase royalty rates from 20 to 25% of lease sales passed the State House in January, but it died in the Senate Finance Committee. Stephanie Garcia Richard runs that office as state land commissioner. She explained her reasoning at the time through a statement to news organizations, saying in part, quote, "I think it makes perfect sense to forego millions now in exchange for billions down the road," end quote. Reactions to the decision are mixed and largely fall along party lines. Several Republican state lawmakers are upset, with Representative Jim Townsend of Artesia calling it, quote, "pettiness at its finest." But Democrats, like Senate Finance Committee Chair George Munoz of Gallup, agree that holding out for a bigger payday makes the most sense. In my interview with Commissioner Garcia Richard, I try to understand her department's vital role in collecting state revenue, and to hear why she thinks withholding leases will help us cash in long term. State Land Commissioner Stephanie Garcia Richard, thanks so much for joining me here today.
It's great to be here, Lou. Thanks.
Now, I just explained a bit of background on your decision with to withhold oil and gas leases on certain tracts of land. And I'll get there in this conversation in a second, but I want to just start with some background for our viewers. What exactly does the State Land Office do?
Yeah, so can I just start by thanking you all for covering this issue?
Sure.
You know, for us, it's pretty front of mind. And, you know, for your viewers that aren't familiar with the State Land Office, probably the most important office you've never heard of. So essentially, we've got 13 million acres of our public trust land, and we elect an individual every 4 years to manage that land on our behalf. We manage it for drawing revenue for New Mexico's public schools, universities, and hospitals. Last year, we made almost $3 billion with a B, dollars on those 13 million acres.
Can you expand a little bit more on where the money from those natural resource leases goes?
So back before we became a state, there were a number of named institutions, named out actually in our state's constitution. We call them beneficiaries. And more specifically, they are New Mexico's K-12 public school students, most of the universities, including UNM in the state, some a few hospitals, and then other various diverse institutions. But essentially, we say New Mexico's public schools, universities, and hospitals. That covers it.
Okay. You lease the land. Who sets the royalty rate for those leases that generates that money?
Great question. So on every other lease instrument we have at the State Land Office, so we've got Walmarts on state land, we've got affordable housing, every lease besides oil and gas, the State Land Commissioner can set whatever terms they deem appropriate for that lease. For the oil and gas leases, those are statutory. So those were passed by the state legislature back, you know, decades ago, actually now 100 years ago. They are updated by statute, by the state legislature. And so things including the rates that we can set for royalty are decided by the legislature.
Understood. Okay, so staying with the state legislature. A royalty rate increase came up this year, as a matter of fact. And the proposal that failed would have revised that royalty rate from 20 to 25%. Can you give us a ballpark dollar amount for how much money that difference amounts to?
And just to clarify, we've attempted this same effort. This is, I think, our fourth time that we've done it.
Okay.
So since 2019, we have been trying to pass this bill. So yes, it would take the royalty that oil and gas companies pay to us to develop our public minerals from 20% to 25%, and it is the LFC that has determined that would be an extra between $50 and $80 million per year, extra revenue on these leases. But then the nice thing about that revenue, it goes into the permanent fund, where it would earn, the SIC estimates, between $1.5 to $2 billion additional dollars.
Okay. Now, you've said that New Mexico's been charging below market rate for years. You mentioned 4 years now. You've been trying to increase it. How do you calculate that market rate?
So there's a couple of different things that we can look at. We run our monthly lease sales on a national, it's essentially an online auction house that runs leases in the Permian Basin, where we're talking about now, but nationwide. And knows the rates that those leases go for, knows the parcels. So they have shared with us information that indicates folks are paying for leases in the area that we're talking about from other oil companies, from private landowners, other landowners, including Texas, that they are paying 25% for those leases. So within that same area, and we're talking about the premier prime tracts of the Permian Basin, those leases are going, we hear from either, you know, other landowners, we hear from the other state that shares the Permian with us, Texas, we hear from national folks who do oil and gas leasing, that the leases in that area, if they are premier, will go for 25%.
Okay, forgive me for getting in the weeds just a little bit, but this webpage, who runs that webpage? And you're saying that these oil and gas companies are looking on a webpage, literally, and they see the royalty rates, and some are 25 and ours are 20.
It's not that they see the royalty rate there, it's that the folks, so this online, it's called EnergyNet, okay?
Right.
It is an online auction house, essentially. Okay. And folks can go and look at these leases and they can bid for a 25% royalty rate.
Okay.
So bidders. If bidders would like to acquire these leases, they can bid that 25% royalty rate. Now, they can't bid for that amount on New Mexico leases because we are, like I said before, held at the 20% for our leases by statute.
Okay. So the increase doesn't make it out of the roundhouse. What's stopping your office from issuing, say, a one-year lease at the 20% that's set right now while waiting for another crack at the 25 increase this upcoming year?
Yeah, so great question, Lou. Again, the terms of the lease are not set by the land commissioner. They are set in statute. So the terms of our lease are on five-year lease terms, and folks who get these leases have that long amount of time to develop them, to get them into production. I will say that even if we did a shortened lease with the lower amount, we still would be leaving money on the table, because very often the earliest years of a lease are their most productive.
Okay. So you want to save those productive years for when we have that 25%, ideally.
Absolutely.
And if we were to sign that now, we'd be locked in for at least 5 years based on statute.
That's it.
Okay. So when exactly did you come to the decision to withhold these leases?
So I wish I could have said 6 years ago. I wish we thought of this 6 years ago, because the attention that we're getting from this decision, what it shows me is that these leases truly are lucrative, because we've done other withholdings before. So we withheld some tracts in the Chaco region. We did an executive order to say we're not going to lease within a mile of any school facilities. Neither of those two actions got near the attention that this action got. And I think the reason is because people understand that this is a lucrative play they're missing out on. Okay. So we've been kind of thinking through, you know, a number of different actions to really push this issue. We could potentially be sued by one of our beneficiaries for not doing our fiduciary duty, which is to bring in the best and highest value for this land. So absent a lawsuit from one of our beneficiaries to say, hey, land office, why aren't you charging market rate? Why aren't you charging the highest rate for the land that you manage on our behalf? Short of that, what we decided to do, and you know, Lou, this is not an entire leasing ban. It is only on those premier tracts. And I made that decision after this last legislative session.
Understood. Now, were you and your representatives involved in lobbying with the legislature this year to try to get that increase done? And what did you hear about why it didn't happen?
I mean, you're going to hear a lot of things. So we tried to pass this bill in 2019. At that time, we heard, the industry is doing so well. Why are you going to, add an additional cost to their bottom line? But when the bottom goes out of the oil and gas economy, we hear the very same thing. Oh, the industry is doing so poorly. Why would you kick them when they're down? I mean, this truly, for me, is my fiduciary obligation. My fiduciary obligation is not to the oil and gas industry. It is to the school children of New Mexico. And it's my job. The voters elected me to get the highest and best value for their public minerals.
Now, Republican lawmakers, the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, and the Albuquerque Journal editorial board have accused you of everything from pettiness to holding school children hostage to violating the state constitution. What do you have to say to those criticisms?
I when I hear the kerfuffle that this has caused, it actually settles me even more comfortably into making this decision, because I know that the reason that people are in such arms about this is because what we have here is there is truly something at stake. There is truly something of value at stake. And, you know, is it petty to be greedy on behalf of school kids? If so, I will take it. I will take it. I mean, you know, we live in a capitalist system, and usually greed is a little bit of a value. But when someone, a public official, has greed on behalf of public school kids, somehow that's not acceptable. You know, if the oil companies are making historic revenue, we should be getting our share of that.
Now, the governor, a member of your own party, suggested that you, quote, listen to all stakeholders, unquote, as you make these kinds of decisions. How did you interpret that comment?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that, and I look forward to working with her, if not in this upcoming special session, if she calls it, maybe in the next legislative session. I do look forward to gaining her support for this. I hope that I have it. I will tell you, Lou, when we started on this journey in 2019, the very first thing we did was an industry working group. Folks in the industry have known about this proposal to raise royalty rates since 2019. We brought them along in crafting the bill. They wanted all kinds of limits on production numbers and things like that. And so in the end, we decided what was best for the trust and the school kids was just to do a flat 25%, but only on the best leases. We have had probably, we're in our sixth year of conversation with stakeholders. So I appreciate the advice. But like I said, I feel very confident about this decision.
Okay. Now that you've made that decision, what comes next? Are we relying completely on the state legislature to pass that increase next year?
We are. And I don't know if we have to wait till next year. If there is a special session, I will try to get it on the call.
Okay. And if they don't, and if it fails again, are you going to hold out again?
Absolutely. I mean, until this is changed, we are leaving money on the table. We are leaving money behind. And, you know, this is money we will never get again. Once these leases are developed, that opportunity ended to get this higher amount, this extra revenue.
This may be in the weeds a little bit too, but say the 25% isn't on the table for whatever political reason. Is there a way to negotiate down the years of a lease? Right now they're set at 5, like you mentioned earlier. Could you try to convince state legislators to offer smaller leases so that we could generate some money in the meantime?
I would love any opportunity for the land commissioner to have a little bit more leverage on the oil and gas lease, whatever that is. I would love to offer that for myself or future land commissioners. So, you know, that's not necessarily off the table. Like I said before, once the lease is drilled and starts producing and starts developing, those early years is what we really want to capture.
Okay. Now, I want to shift a little bit more broadly. We've been talking about oil and gas development. We know that has significant impacts on the environment locally, globally, but renewable development too. It has impacts on the environment. Solar farms. How does your office mitigate impacts like those now and into the future, especially as these projects grow and create more and more industrialized landscapes?
Yeah, so the nice thing about, like I said before in the beginning of the interview, every other instrument that we enter into at the state land office, we set the terms, the commissioner and the staff set the terms. So the nice thing about the renewable energy leases is we can set whatever terms we deem to be necessary to protect wildlife, habitat, ecosystems. We have been putting together something we call best management practices. Those actually have become part of the renewable energy leases and the project plans that folks come to us to build out either solar, wind, transmission on state land have to have best management practices, which were written actually by our specialists that are wildlife biologists, rangeland ecologists, folks who actually understand the science behind what a best management practice would be. Not only that, I don't know if you want to get into this whole other issue, but because we don't have control over the oil and gas leases, what happens after all of that infrastructure winds down and plugging those leases and bonding on those leases has not been, I would say, has not been fully covered for state land. On the renewable energy leases, we can build in that deconstruction winding down of a lease, the bonding on removing all of that infrastructure right into the lease for a renewable energy lease, and we do that.
Okay. Now, obviously, as we've talked about, the main part of your job is to generate money from natural resources, including these renewable resources. Is part of your calculus thinking about landscapes, thinking about protecting our landscapes as a good investment in and of itself?
That's such a great question, Lou, and absolutely, that is part of the calculus. In fact, that is sort of the calculus. The mandate on the office in the state's constitution essentially says, land commissioner, raise revenue, but don't do it at the long-term expense of the land. You have to ensure that you are looking out for that long-term health. And for me, the long-term health of the land includes wildlife, includes air quality, includes water quality. We really do look at development or any applications, recommendations for land leases into the land office with as much of a holistic landscape level as possible. And in fact, like the federal government, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, is considering leasing land for conservation purposes. We are doing the same thing at the state land office, looking at our really critical habitat and ecosystems that are a little bit more fragile, not putting necessarily any kind of development on them, but leasing them to conserve and preserve the acres, to ensure their long-term health.
Stephanie Garcia-Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks again to the State Land Commissioner for making the time to explain her decision to withhold those oil and gas leases. The state legislature is in for a big shakeup after the November election. Earlier this month, both House Minority Leader T. Ryan Lane and Senate Minority Leader Greg Baca announced they would not seek re-election. Those moves added to a growing list of legislative seats to be filled by voters this fall. It now stands at 19. 12 of those seats are held by Republicans, and the other 7 by Democrats. The potential for a statewide political shakeup might seem huge, but how competitive are those districts really? I try to answer that question in our next segment as I sit down with former State Senator Dee Dee Feldman. We'll also try to nail down why there's so much turnover this year and the ripple effects it could have leading into and after this fall's election. I want to thank Democratic former State Senator Dee Dee Feldman for joining me on the show this week. We, of course, know her quite well here on New Mexico in Focus, and this week we're going to lean on her political expertise a little bit more broadly as we take stock of some of these departures from the state legislature that I just mentioned. Thanks so much, Dee Dee.
Thank you, Lou.
Now, 19 legislative seats are open as we cruise towards the election in November. Can you remember a time where there's been this much turnover in one single election year?
Well, that sounds like a lot, doesn't it? 19, that's almost 20%. Well, I look back and found out that it is not as big as you might think, because in 2012, which is the year that I retired from the New Mexico Senate, there was 20% of the legislature that retired at that time, and 11 people in the Senate. So that's more than this year. It seems more noticeable, I guess, just because it's happening now, but sure. That was a big change too. I don't know, the difference now, it seems like they're not just retirements, but they're also younger people are retiring. For various reasons, some because of politics. They were paired, Greg Baca, I think, in the Senate was paired with another Republican. Okay. And others just because it's so hard to be a legislator now if you're a single mom or if you're a working person.
Sure. Now, some of the coverage around the mass departure has left the impression that the balance of power could be in question. Based on the research that you've done and what you know about these districts, is that framing accurate, do you think?
No, I think that you would think that with open seats, there would be more chance for the minority party to gain. But it's not always true because it depends upon how the map is drawn. And I've looked at the 11, I think it's 11 vacant seats in the House and 10 in the Senate. Of those, only two or three on either side, I think two or three on the Senate side and maybe three or four on the House side, are swing seats that could actually go either Republican or Democrat. So, so it's likely that there won't be that much partisan change. And remember that the vast majority of the people that are stepping down this time are Republicans, and they are in safe seats. So it's most likely that a Republican will take their place and not a Democrat. So and the same is true for the Democrats. For example, Gail Chasey, that's a solidly Democratic seat. So you don't expect a Republican pickup there.
Okay. Yeah. Now, purely from a political science perspective, let's talk about how competitive the New Mexico legislature is and how that plays into the decisions from these lawmakers to outright leave or just decide not to run for re-election.
Well, the national organization Ballotpedia says that the New Mexico legislature is not very competitive, even when you factor in the large number of contested primaries. But what that boils down, and it's about 30% competitive, and that's not very good, and it's getting worse. It's getting worse since 2010. I think it was their first one. And you can measure that also by the number of open seats. There are open seats, but they're not contested or competitive open seats. So it's not very competitive. The seats you would think would be competitive because there's no incumbent. See, that's the conventional wisdom, that when there's no incumbent, then it's more competitive for the opposition party. But when the lines are drawn by the legislators themselves to protect the incumbents, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, then the turnover is much less.
Okay.
Much less.
What's the impact of a lack of competition, both for the electoral process, but also for the social discourse and the political discourse in our state, for the public who are watching these races and trying to get ideas in their heads?
Well, just consider this, Lou. In the Senate, for example, this year, there are 11 or 12 seats that are completely uncontested in either the general or the primary. And in the House, it's even worse. 37% of the seats in the House have no opposition in either the primary or the general. Well, in other words, they're shoo-ins, and they're shoo-ins because they're safe districts. So what does that do to the general public, this lack of competition? Well, it makes you less likely to vote. Who wants to vote? If the results are preordained, and also it makes people less likely to want to run for office. So it's harder to recruit candidates to run in a seat which they know they will lose, because the registration edge of Democrat to Republican is such that they can never rise above a certain level. So, it's very discouraging. And what it does, I think, is it diminishes civic engagement across the board. People don't feel that they have power to change things in Santa Fe. And so, therefore, why should they participate in those issues, in those elections?
Okay. Now, you mentioned this briefly, but primary elections.
Yeah.
What have you found about competition in those versus in the general, and how are those competitive races in primaries rather than in the general? How does that affect political discourse within parties and for voters, too?
Well, that's the key question, because that's where the real juice is now. The real juice is in primaries. And while there are a lot of uncontested seats in general elections between the Republicans and the Democrats, there are more and more contested primaries. And that's a national trend. That's not just in New Mexico. So in the Senate this year, 26% of the seats are contested in primaries. And let's see, in the House, I think it is 17% are contested in primaries. So what that means is the debate becomes directed toward the fringes. So in order to get elected in a Republican primary, you have to get those voters on the fringe. And in order to get elected in a Democratic primary in a safe district, let's say like the North Valley, where I was the senator, you have to please those people who are on the fringes, who are also most active voters in primaries. So what does that do? Well, it elects more extreme candidates on either side. And then once they are elected, because they usually face no general election opposition, that makes compromise coalitions much more unlikely during the session. So it sort of makes the partisan divide deeper. And it also, I think, encourages people who are in the minority party, and even some that are in the majority party, to not want to be legislators anymore because it's too vicious. It's too frustrating on either side to hear the same ideological remarks all the time, rather than the more practical efforts to solve problems that the state faces.
Okay. Now, so we've established we have no reason to believe that Democrats will lose the control of the majority in either the House or the Senate.
I say that of the open seats, there are not many swing seats, but some of the districts which have sitting incumbents are swing districts.
Okay.
So, for example, the Corrales district in Albuquerque, which has an incumbent there, a Democratic incumbent, that's a swing district. And the some of the seats up in the Heights of Albuquerque that have incumbents, I would say Senator Martin Hickey's district, for example, Senator Mark Moore's district, that's a vacant seat. But Hickey's he's the incumbent. That could be a swing seat too. So don't, and also down in, down near Socorro, Tara Jaramillo, her seat will be contested by, the longtime Republican representative who ran for governor and lost. So those seats can be swing as well.
Okay.
So it's not preordained.
Sure.
But
sure.
It's, if I was to bet, I would bet that there will not be that much change in the numbers in either the Senate or the House.
Understood. And if the majority and the minorities do stay the way that they are right now, what will this election say, or what could this election say about what kind of minority Democrats will have to work with from the Republican side?
Well, the Republicans who win in the general election or in the minority, you should look at who wins in the primaries.
Okay.
To see how things will shake out during the session, to see who is elected. One trend that's kind of different this year, I think, is the large number of people coming from the House to the Senate. And we're seeing that, and there are two House members now that are running for the Senate, Natalie Figueroa and Candy Ezell. There's one House member that is currently in the Senate, Greg Nybert from the Roswell area. and there's Mo Maestas, who was in the House. That's kind of a counter trend that's kind of new. So, you have to factor that in. But it could be, I think the conventional wisdom will be is that the Republicans will get more extreme, and the Democrats who face primaries. And remember, 4 years ago, a number of Democratic senators were swept out in the Democratic primaries.
Okay.
And so everything could get a little bit more partisan.
Let's stick with the Democrats. Are there any factions forming within the party? I spoke with the state land commissioner a little bit earlier on the show, and she was hoping for an increase in the rate that we charge for oil and gas leases.
Yes.
That got through the House. It was stopped in the Senate Finance Committee. Is that some sort of an example about these more entrenched voices in the Democratic Party coming out on top? And is there any internal ideological fight going on here?
Well, I think that you see in the House some discontent among conservative Democrats with the general liberal agenda there. But I don't think it's going to really carry through to the Senate. I think that when you're talking about the failure of oil and gas rate increases, you really have to look at the power of the oil and gas industry and the contributions they make and the lobbyists that they field on both the Republican and the Democratic side. So that may not be the issue, I think, of division between, for example, liberal Democrats and conservative Democrats.
Okay.
But there are others, you know, gun control, for example, would be one, I think, and abortion. Those two have typically been issues that have appealed to a few, in this case, a few, maybe five or six conservative Democrats in both the Senate or the House. And that's made it difficult for the majority of Democrats.
Okay, so considering everything that we've talked about, what does all of this say about the nature of public service in New Mexico? The Legislative Council Service just voted 9-3 to fund a $6 million study on modernization. That, of course, includes paying lawmakers. How would that change many of the things that we've talked about today, from competition to voter interest to ideologies for lawmakers themselves?
Well, start off with the fact that we have so many of the seats now that are uncontested. And that means that people don't want to run. They think that it is going to be a losing proposition financially and also because they're not going to win. Now, the data about modernization of the legislature says that if you pay legislators, if they have a staff, which they don't really have now for rank and file legislators, then more people will want to run because it'll be more attractive to be a senator and to be a representative. And you won't have to sacrifice your business. You won't have to completely sacrifice your family life. So there will be more people that want to run for office. There will be more contested elections. Will they be more competitive? Well, and will the composition of Republicans and Democrats change? Probably not, as long as the legislature is drawing the lines to protect incumbents. Then that will sort of freeze the map so that even though you have more contested elections and more civic participation, the outcome may not be that different. So it's worth doing for many reasons, though, and many of them boil down to you want to reward public service. You want to make it more humane for people to serve in the legislature during longer sessions where they're not up all night for three nights making bad decisions because of that's the way it's set up.
Thank you so much, Democratic former State Senator Dee Dee Feldman.
Thanks, Lou.
Thanks for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow along with us on our social media pages during the week. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, April 1st, 2024. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.